The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Monday, the 14th of September, 2020. On the podcast today, Clive Beattie, acting CEO of On The Market, that's OTMP ticker, and Clive discusses their listing agreement with Taylor Wimpey, one of the largest house builders in the UK. Also on the podcast, Robert Ross, Joint Interim Chief Executive Officer of Expediator, talks through some of the highlights from the interim results. And Paul Hill talks to James Bevan and James A. of CCLA about ethical investing. They mention loads of stocks, in fact, listed around the world, but specifically in the UK, they mention Boohoo and Unilever. Also on the podcast, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, check out our COVID-19 index. Biggest rise of the day is Symphony Environmental, up 20%. Biggest fall of the day is N4 Pharma, down 37%. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Clive Beattie, Acting Chief Executive Officer of On The Market, and that's OTMP, of course. Clive, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Good morning.
Yeah, some good news out today. One of the major house builders have joined with On The Market there, and we'll dig into that in a bit. But as always, quickly, Clive, for someone who's not heard of On The Market, I don't know where they are, because your advertising campaign is very successful and it cuts through, I think. I've been addicted to singing the theme tune for a while. So just for people not familiar, just briefly explain On The Market, please.
Of course. So we're a leading UK residential property portal. And what that means is we display properties for estate and letting agents and new home developers. And then consumers can browse the portal on themarket.com and view properties or look for local agents if they want to get in contact about their own property, if they're potentially selling or letting properties. And so they can buy or sell, view, let, rent through the site.
Yeah. So the new house builder joining you, listing on the site, is Taylor Wimpey. That's an excellent sign, isn't it?
We're very pleased indeed. I mean, obviously, Taylor Wimpey are one of the largest UK house builders out there. I think, last year they probably did something like 15,700 odd completions, which, puts them in the top three. So clearly a delight to have them joining, many others who have signed up with us. Our new homes, we actually only launched the new home site around a year ago in September 2019. And it's grown strongly with, a number of the leading players, but also many of the smaller developers in the country.
Yeah, well, when we spoke last week, you said, I asked for the three reasons why someone should, follow all the metrics you look at, and you said what's very important is the stock you're available on the site, and now you've got, probably four of the biggest house builders in the UK, haven't you?
Yes, probably have. As well as Taylor Wimpey, people like Persimmon, Barratt, Bellways are already with us, amongst others. So, yeah, we are very pleased. It's growing quickly. And exactly as you say, it is important for us that when consumers come to the website, they see a wide range of choice of properties that meet their criteria. And clearly, adding the stock that Taylor Wimpey have across its many developments, all across the UK, it will be great for us and great for consumers coming to the site.
Yeah, and surely when you have those house builders, four of the biggest pretty much on your side, it must make the job easier approaching other house builders saying these guys are on the site already.
Well, I'd like to think so. I mean, obviously, we're still talking with others. We'd like to have all of them. But each has their own reasons. But I think, yes, you're right. There is, the critical mass does mean that people, particularly those people who are specifically looking for new homes rather than perhaps the second-hand market, if they're seeing more and more properties here, they'll come and they'll create very valuable leads and get in touch with the developers on our site. And I think for any developer, that's what they're after. They're after motivated buyers who will end up visiting their developments, hopefully buying their properties. So the more we have and the more of those consumers we attract, you would think that would give us a stronger reason for others joining us.
Yeah, and talking about that sort of getting traction and stuff, like I said, we spoke last week because because you delivered another month of record leads, and that was beating the previous month. And you also seem to be generating cash at the moment.
Yes, on the cash side, I think we've said before, when we entered particularly the lockdown phase of COVID pandemic, clearly that was very difficult for our customers. They couldn't sell houses for estate and letting agents. They couldn't open their developments for the new homes builders. So effectively, we gave discounts to them to help them through that period. Indeed, those discounts are still running as of today. But that reduced our revenues, clearly, and we had to look at our own cash and how we conserved that, and took some various measures, both staff-related in terms of furlough, but also, importantly, reducing marketing expenditure. So actually what we've done during the period, we gave the figures last week, we've still managed to conserve a strong cash position, a net cash position, notwithstanding that, through the measures we've taken. And, that disciplined approach to cash management and cost management is something that I would see going forward that we'll retain. So, we're now in a position where we hope to see our revenue start growing again as the worst of the pandemic hopefully is behind us. But we won't suddenly start, splurging the cash just because of that. I think you'll see our expenditure grow, our marketing expenditure will grow, but hopefully be growing in line with our revenues and therefore still conserving our cash that's on the balance sheet.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, you are pretty much, I suppose, a disruptor in this field. You seem like you are starting to disrupt here with these big signings and these record leads happening. And disruptors are sort of synonymous with not making money at the start there. And now you are generating cash. And do you have aims? Do you have a line in the sand where you're going to be break-even and profitable? Or is that not the aim yet?
Well, that's probably not good of me to start giving any profit forecasts out. So, but all I'd say is, yes, we've had a lot of significant investment to get us to the place we are. I mean, it takes a long time and a lot of money to establish a portal and get the brand awareness, widespread brand awareness around the country. And that investment, a large part of that, I'd say, is behind us. I mean, there's work to do, but we've made significant inroads, which I think these leads and the consumer traction we're getting demonstrate. So I think, as I say, I think the aim now is, to start to turn that, to grow the revenues. We've got substantial opportunity in the short term for revenue growth through the conversion of those who initially joined us on free contracts just to get more stock on site for us. And if we can do that successfully, I think we'll be in a very strong position going forward.
Yeah, and the upside, the potential there is very big, isn't it? Cause if you look at the main player, Rightmove, I know, they're valued at $5.4 billion, and yet on the market at the moment is valued at $66 million. So the upside, but I'm not saying you get that level, but even if you get a tenth of what they're at, that's still a big potential upside, isn't it?
Look, I think so. I mean, there's a huge disparity, obviously, and we're not going to suddenly become the size of Rightmove, as you rightly say. And part of that is because part of our offering and the reason we're attractive to agents and house builders is we don't price as high as they do. So, we are very good value for money, we think, and that's one of our strengths. Mm-hmm. And, of course, part of our disruption strategy. Look, I think if we can make this business work, continue to grow the advertisers on site, continue to grow the paying advertisers on site, I think we've got a strong business, and I guess at that point it's up for the market to determine what that's worth.
Excellent stuff. Okay, as always, Clive, you should know these by now. In fact, we spoke with this last week, but for someone not following you, but like the sound of the progress you're making today, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add On the Market to their watch list, please.
Of course. So number one, I'd say our revenue growth prospects. In the short term, that's fees from agents and new home developers, and there's significant growth potential there. And in the medium term, we didn't touch on it so much this time, but we're looking to use the platform to distribute technology-enabled products and services, additional things to agents and new homes developers. So that's more the medium-term growth. The second point, I think we've got a very differentiated proposition. We've got strong agent ownership and support. We're majority owned by agents. They support us through things like our new and exclusive properties, where we get thousands of properties each month, before they're on Rightmove or Zoopla, and that gives us a strong pull with the consumers who want to see those properties, you know, first and get into the process if they're the right property for them before others. And as I say, we've got something like a third of the agency market as shareholders, which gives us a strong footing and you know, positions us well. And then the third point is, I think, the strength of the management team and our financial discipline we've just touched on. Obviously, the management strength has been enhanced with the recent appointment of Jason Tebb, who's joining us in December as Chief Executive. And it's evidenced by the cash conservation we've managed to achieve during these challenging COVID times and the net cash on the balance sheet.
Excellent stuff, Clive. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin. Have a great week.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Robert Ross, Joint Interim Chief Executive Officer of Expeditor. XPD is ticker. Robert, thanks for joining me.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And you've just released your 6 months results at the end of June, and yes, very resilient considering we've been through a pandemic, and the likes of which we're probably not going to see again, hopefully, for another sort of lifetime. But yeah, we'll get into those in a bit. But before we do, Robert, for people not familiar maybe with Expeditor, just summarise the company if you could, please.
Yeah, no problem. So Expeditor is a logistics and freight management company. We've got three main divisions, the largest of which is the freight forwarding division. So it's the majority of which is European road freight. So mainly in the UK and Central and Eastern Europe, but we also do air freight and sea freight as well. We've then got a warehousing and logistics division, which has a Pallex franchise in Romania, and then warehousing in the UK and Romania. And then our third division is our Affinity Transport Solutions division, which is a one-stop shop for hauliers with fuel cards, ferry crossings, insurance, leasing, and the like.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, so the half-year results on the 30th of June. Yeah. Summarise the key points, if you could, Robert.
Yeah, so a really pleasing set of results for the first half of the year. So adjusted pre-tax profit is up on last year, despite revenue being down. So we had a strong start to the year in terms of the first quarter of 2020. Obviously, then the pandemic hit, and there was quite a sharp decline in volumes across the business, really, in April. We then sort of, after two or three weeks, hit a sort of point. We didn't go any lower from there, but sort of stayed at that level for 5-6 weeks, and then came back up towards the middle end of May, and then have gone back to pre-COVID levels since then, really. So sort of very pleased in terms of the results of the business, the resilience, the way we've been able to flex our cost base and also take cost out of the business permanently. The freight forwarding business performed very strongly. That's up on last year. The warehouse and logistics, a mixed bag in there, so strong in Romania and less so in the UK. And then the Affinity business just suffered from lower volumes within the haulage market in Europe, really. But that, again, is pretty much back to those pre-COVID levels.
Yeah. And just go through it, because just getting there. So which parts of the markets were sort of good and bad, or strong and weak? What happened there? Give some details there.
Yeah, so starting with freight forwarding. So there's quite a few things sort of going on in freight forwarding. So we have the first point is there's an e-commerce subdivision in there. So we actually closed one of the smaller parts of the business that wasn't really going anywhere. Then in terms of our e-shop WeDrop business, cut the cost base in that, and the losses have narrowed in there. And then our regional express business, which has got the contract with Amazon, has seen the volumes of the Amazon customs clearance come through, and then also the business that the freight forwarding and the warehousing business they do is performed better as well. So we've had a good that part of the business is still slightly loss making, but a good improvement year on year, and going into the second half of the year we expect that to be profitable. In Central and Eastern Europe, Lithuania and Bulgaria have been very strong. So they exited last year with some good contracts that they were working with, which continued into the first quarter. And then they were very agile in their selling, really, and during the COVID period, you know, helped across the freight forwarding division by knowing which hauliers were running via our Affinity business, so we can see who's drawing fuel. We're able to get some really good rates and just very good buying from those the team. Teams in Lithuania and Bulgaria. Our Estonian and Serbian businesses also matured from last year. So from not making much money last year, they made good money this year. And then in the UK, a bit of a mixed bag. So our domestic business grew well, But then our sort of more traditional freight forwarding business, which has some exposure to China and also to Italy, was impacted negatively. So overall, from freight forwarding, a very strong sort of position. Mm-hmm. And then just moving very quickly onto the logistics business, as I say, Palex performed very well throughout the COVID period. It was down in April, but sort of got those volumes back pretty quickly. And the Romania logistics business performed well as well. The warehouses are all pretty much full now. Performed strongly. In the UK, a bit more of a mixed bag. So our EMT business, which are hanging garments, you know, obviously exposed to the high street, that's been impacted and continues to be impacted. But we have sort of restructured that business, and it's in good shape now when the volumes come back. Our business import services in Southampton has been impacted by lower inbound volumes from the Far East, really. It's very much a toy business. But again, those are now coming back, and it's performing much better. And then the Braintree warehouse actually performed well in some areas exposed to e-commerce, and then in other areas a bit more challenging, where we had sort of retail customers. And then finally, from an affinity perspective, as I said before, the drop in diesel being drawn, I mean, it's sort of 40% down across Europe, impacted that business. But again, back to pretty much where we were pre-COVID now, and just performing as it was previously.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? One of the most popular questions at the moment, of course, and for any company or business when I'm asked them, is the impact of COVID-19. But of course, sometimes it can be positive as well as negative, can't it?
Yes. Yeah, we've seen it's been very varied, really. So those we've tried to be as flexible as possible. Those areas that we can get into, for example, you know, refrigerated transport or transportation of any goods that are really needed, or those e-commerce areas, we've sort of gone into as much as we can. The other areas, the more traditional areas, you know, some parts of the business, customers have shut up shop for 2 or 3 months. So there's really nothing we've been able to do. But we're sort of up and down across the business, really. It's net negative, the impact, definitely. But there are definitely you know, ups and downs across the business.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, has it caused you? And I suppose you know, a lot of businesses during situations like COVID, it makes them look at their business and focus on the areas that the strengths, maybe, you know, cut some costs that they thought they, you know, they're looking at doing anyway. Is it sort of accelerated anything in your business, you know, going forward?
Yes, definitely. So, in terms of the central cost base, we've had a good look at that and cut cost with that. You know, we were slightly out of control from a cost perspective last year, I feel. And from an IT perspective, we really need to get up the curve very quickly. We did a lot of that last year. For me, I'm keen just to move forward at a more controlled pace. So we have cut costs from an IT perspective as well. So within the sort of M&A, IT, central costs, we've taken out what will end up being $500,000 of annualized cost savings. Across the rest of the business, you know, obviously we had furlough as well, which was very helpful, which took cost out of the business. And we continue to look at all areas of the business. You know, we're looking to be as efficient as possible. We're looking to move onto the digitalization page. That's the future of the industry. It just allows us to be more competitive. The more digitalized we can be, the less people we need in the business ultimately, and then the lower our cost to service.
Yeah, absolutely. Going forward, it's as if we haven't got enough on our plate. It's, you know, Brexit is around the corner. What does this mean for Expediator?
Yeah, so I mean, for me, Brexit is a really good opportunity for us. We're less exposed to Brexit as perhaps some more sort of traditional UK based European road freight businesses, just because a lot of our business is within Europe anyway, so that won't be impacted. But the business we do have between the UK and Europe, there is an opportunity from the customs clearance business. You know, we're already doing customs clearance for Amazon sellers that are in Asia, and we've got opportunities to do that in the UK, and there will be loads and loads and loads of businesses that are looking to receive help with their customs clearance. We've got a team set up in Romania, which allow us to do it at a lower cost than in the UK. The declarations will have to be made in the UK, which will be done by a UK-based team. But it allows us to get through more volume with the team that's already up and running and experienced and currently doing customs clearance for us in Romania. So we sort of see it as a big opportunity. There will be, as I say, there'll be be lots of businesses that really need help, and we'll be pushing that as we approach the turn of the year, and ready to help out any businesses that need it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Okay, so let's, you know, if people are liking the sound of this, Robert, but are not yet following the story, could you give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Fox Markets and add Expedia to their watch list, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, for me, there are lots of interesting revenue opportunities within the group. You know, we are in lots of different markets, and we've got lots of very good people, and as I say, lots of very interesting opportunities. The second half of the year is always stronger for us. On average, of the last 4 years, the profitability has been 60% in the second half of the year. And the sort of final reason is that we've got lots of sort of cost out initiatives across the group as well. We're looking to be more efficient. We're looking to become a better business. And for me, it's a really exciting time for Expediator.
Excellent stuff. Robert, good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Perfect. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted today to have with me James Bevan and James Eyre of CCLA, two of the smartest ESG investors in the country with around £10 billion under management. Welcome, guys.
Great to be with you.
Good morning.
Now, ESG is definitely growing in importance. Could you just quickly take us through what the sort of the key drivers are, the sort of the growth rates and the size of the industry?
Well, kicking off with scale, it's simply enormous. Over $40 trillion is now managed according to ESG principles. That's doubled in 4 years. That's tripled in 8 years. And the drivers behind this are the very clear recognition that extra financial risks are now really important, not just to saving the planet, trying to drive a superior social outcome, and of course requiring good governance, and therefore necessarily supporting society, but also the clear and certain expectation this is about better financial returns.
And how do you actually go about selecting companies and corporates? Because, I mean, obviously capitalism with a conscience is quite a difficult balance. And it depends on how much you sort of positively and negatively screen. I mean, there's clear sort of like, you know, companies working in armaments and have poor sort of like human rights records will be screened out quite quickly. But I'm looking at some of your portfolio. I mean, you've got Unilever, you've got Amazon, and you've got sort of Roche. And they're squeaky clean in a number of areas, but sort of less so. How do you actually balance that sort of like the pros and cons of a particular company?
Well, Paul, perhaps I can deal with the big picture and then get James to talk about some of the detail. In terms of the big picture, we draw a very significant distinction between ethics, which are about the investors' values, what they care about, and value, which is about trying to maximize long-term returns. And we think the environment, social norms, and governance are really about optimizing long-term investor returns. So we don't see any conflict between high ESG standards and excellent financial returns. Now, how this gets done is, of course, an issue of detail. And here's where I need James to talk about some stock examples.
Sure. So, you know, one of the kind of key issues is that we recognize there's a lot of extra data available to fund managers now to look into and more closely analyze these companies. But we can't just rely on data purely to do all of the work. So ultimately, it comes down to detailed due diligence. You mentioned a few of the companies in our portfolio, and maybe perhaps we can address some of those issues. I mean, first of all, the perfect company on an ESG set of metrics just simply doesn't exist. So you're quite right. There's a balancing act to be had. And so there's also, you know, an understanding of the relative merits of a company in its sector and in the global investable universe. So if we take Unilever, Unilever recognizes as a company that the world is changing fast and that it needs to change with it. So it started relatively early back in 2010 with a sustainable living plan, which really is designed to accelerate the company's growth, push it towards the correct set of agendas, which ultimately its consumers are demanding. So more natural products would be one good example. And then try and decouple that growth from the sort of heavier environmental impacts than simply pursuing a cause such as, you know, untraceable palm oil, for example. It views as sort of non-sustainable. So it spent a lot of time in its supply chain, trying to understand where it sources its palm oil from and what environmental impact that is having on the planet.
How do you score it, James? How do you actually score that? Do you have sort of like a rating of 100? I mean, how when you do your due diligence, how do you sort of balance the pros and cons up to get a bar of 50 or something? Or
So it's not a scoring process per se. I mean, in governance, we can score companies reasonably easily, and we have a set of metrics and factors, and we've built our own internal governance score to do just that. But in these softer issues, it's more difficult and more nuanced. And so what you can do is you can use third-party data, but you also have to supplement that with engagement with the company and properly understanding some of the softer issues too. So, I mean, you can certainly use that data to score on the ESG metrics, but that's not a substitute for properly understanding whether these companies are on top of their game. And Unilever certainly does stand out as a company that is leading in its field. So it's not as simple as just straightforward scoring in all instances.
Okay, and just going back to the sort of the returns, James B, this one before. What sort of like returns are you looking for with sort of like ESG investing? Would it be, I mean, there used to be always a criticism of environmental or ethical or responsible investing that it would deliver lower returns. But frankly, in the pandemic, it's outperformed the rest of the market. What sort of returns would you expect going forward from sort of like responsible or in ethical investing?
Well, let me stick my neck out and say absolutely that we expect premium returns from high ESG standards, because ESG is about correctly understanding the extra financial risks. And we worry about, therefore, a combination of legislation, regulation, litigation, and customer action saying, look, guys, this is bad. We don't want to be part of this. And that, I think, undermines the case of profitability for many companies. And if they don't fully understand and then manage those risks, there is a real challenge to shareholder value. So I do believe that ESG is primarily about reducing the risks of exposure to companies that have blow-ups simply because they are badly run and badly organised.
And what about the oil and gas sector? I mean, that used to be such a large weighting of the FTSE and sort of a driver for dividends for income investors. And now you get a large swathe of the investing community basically saying it's uninvestable because of its carbon footprint.
Yes, Paul, there are some very interesting challenges here, one of which relates to the whole challenge of so-called stranded assets. And stranded assets refers to the challenge that many companies are valued on the basis of their hydrocarbon reserves. But if we burnt all of the carbon reserves, the climate change that we would then experience would shut down the planet. And therefore, there is a very clear expectation that legislation and regulation will deny that happening. So we cannot reasonably value oil and gas companies based on their reserves. We have to instead think about the interaction of their financial returns with their capacity to operate on an ongoing basis, particularly as sustainable energy is now receiving so much more investment and is price competitive. And I equally do believe that people who look at the oil and gas sector as just large in capitalization terms ignore the reality that active value really should be adding value for investors. It's about making sure that you are focused on the future and not the past. And of course, oil and gas are hugely indexed because they are yesterday's industry and have continued to operate in that space.
And when you also like you're balancing your returns with your ESG investment, let's just hypothetically say one of your investments does really, really, really well and zooms up, no pun intended, to a sort of like astronomical evaluation, maybe an Amazon or a Beyond Meat or something which has got a lot of momentum. Would you ever sell an ESG compliant investment on valuation terms?
Do you want me to answer that one, Joe?
Absolutely, we would, Paul. Our task primarily is to deliver fantastic long-term investment returns, of which ESG is part. And perhaps I can hand over to James now to talk a little bit about some of the recent trends that we have done, recognizing that price and value have to stay connected.
Sure thing. So, I mean, to that point, you know, would we ever sell? As James says, yeah, absolutely. I mean, ultimately, we're we're disciplined investors and we want to make investments on a genuinely long-term view. But as investments move to astronomical levels, we typically are trimming them. And, you know, so we've seen this run up in the market post the low in March. We've absolutely taken action. So in August, we were trimming a number of our IT positions, really on the basis that we felt that they got a bit ahead of themselves. And we do think that the potential on a long-term view is still there. But names like PayPal, and as you mentioned, Amazon and Microsoft had all started to move into territory which we felt warranted trims. And we also invested and continue to invest in a small way in a company called Diasorin, which is a testing business. And again, that obviously benefited very substantially from a re-rating linked to the outbreak of COVID. But clearly the market sort of extrapolates out growth ad infinitum. And we're in the process of a pandemic, which ultimately will peter out. So it's unrealistic to extrapolate growth forever. So on that basis, you know, we've severely sort of trimmed that position back too. So you know, price and discipline on valuation is really important within the investment process.
So here's another tricky question, maybe. If you've actually been trimming some of your winners, and therefore, by definition, presumably the population of investable ideas is less in terms of, because a lot of them have been very successful. Where are you actually putting your money, or are you just parking it currently a bit more in cash to give you some firepower when there is a sort of like a better wobble, as there was sort of last week with an 8% correction on NASDAQ? James, or
Mr. A, you talk about some of the names that we've been cycling into, because sure. This is about wanting to continue to identify great investment opportunities, but in global equities remaining invested.
So, I mean, obviously in the market sell-off in March and April, we added and initiated a number of positions there. So we maintain a watch list of stocks, and we often find companies that we really like, but not always at the right valuation. So we try and be very patient and very focused on what we think the right entry point would be for them. So we picked up a small number of stocks back at that point. So Hermes, the luxury goods company, we purchased a starting position in that. Ansys, which is a particularly specialist business. It's an industrial business, but it specializes in physics engines for the testing of engineering models and CAD design. That was another business we picked up. Now, obviously, as we've seen the market premium expand, and as we've got into sort of August, we've still been able to find some good ideas. One of the names that we added to quite significantly kind of early August was TSMC, so Taiwan Semiconductor, which is one of the largest foundries. So there's been a trend.
Very well recently, haven't they, I think? Didn't they sort of like put out some excellent results, largely supplying the cloud and affecting the electronics boom from work at home?
Yes, I mean, you're quite right. I mean, there was a couple of things that played into their favour. I mean, we looked at the stock, went through your 15 times P, it's not 22 times, and really identified it as a valuation anomaly. We've owned the company for many years. We regard it as one of the sort of best in class semi names, and so we added to it on the basis of valuation, and then we had the sort of double benefit. It had a strong set of results, and then one of its competitors, Intel, had a number of issues with their 7-nanometer technology, which obviously saw the stock price move far higher as a result of that. So, I mean, a happy coincidence rather than the deep insight in on our part in terms of the forward-looking potential of these things happening, but really a judgment call based on valuation.
Okay, and then just taking a step back on the macro side, what is your top-level view in terms of sort of where the market's heading? I mean, we've got a sort of like a big contrast between growth and value. I think growth has outperformed value by 30-35% this year. I mean, just look at the FTSE compared to sort of the NASDAQ. And again, just recently, we've had sort of like an increase in infection rates and worries around Brexit, and which has sort of dampened some of the mid-cap and small-cap sectors in the UK. What's your sort of the view in terms of go-forward top level?
Well, to kick off with, the macroeconomic backdrop, we think, is going to be identified by a long period of relatively slow real growth and also quite low inflation for the next couple of years. This in part relates to the inventory overhang that continues to bedevil the global economy. But also it's very interesting seeing how different economies have been responding to the COVID-19 crisis. So, for example, China has been held up as an economy that has been recovering quite quickly. But a lot of China's recovery has been in producing more, in exporting more, and subsidizing those exports in order to be able to build market share. That's really bad news for economies that are developed because they're now having to compete aggressively. It does mean this inflation is being held down. So for the next 6 months or so, we do believe that the principal driver of markets will continue to be central bank and government spending and liquidity. Very hard to see markets having a material turndown until that liquidity dries up. Now that leads us obviously to the question of where is value? And we would argue that the equity risk premium, so the forward excess return from investing in equities relative to bonds, remains very high. We think central banks will hold bond yields down, but bond yields are now representing legal theft. Investors in bonds need to recognize that government debt is being held down by a central bank. And if you or I were to try this at home, we would get sent to jail for market manipulation.
So I guess your portfolio hasn't got that many sort of fixed income and bonds in it.
Absolutely right. It's just a graveyard for people who want to grow the long-term real value of their assets. In contrast, we can see many companies that are high quality, that have high free cash flow, that are sustainable, offering excellent long-term forward returns. As for the risks, I certainly believe that the US presidential election in November is a key factor. Were the Democrats to sweep the presidency plus two houses of Congress, then we would suspect that Mr. Biden's policies would be brought in. We might see $10 taken off index earnings for the S&P 500. We're projecting $150 for the end of 2021. So a $10 reduction in earnings would be quite a swipe in the marketplace.
Yeah.
The other global risk, of course, is what happens between the US and China. Now, at the moment, as we know, most of the rhetoric and action has been on trade. But trade actually is bad for the US consumer because the goods arrive at the US, tariff is then imposed, and all that happens is the US household has to pay more money. So there is a real risk that this now shifts to a war of capital accounts. Can the US stop China having access to the US dollar, and in particular, access to the US dollar debt markets? Now, if this were to happen, we think that the global economy would suffer significantly, and quite rightly, global markets would fall back. So that's a risk we monitor. As for Brexit, we do worry that the domestic economy is going to be mired with difficulties for the foreseeable future. The good news, if there is any on this front, is that the Bank of England is likely to keep the official rate at 10 basis points for all of this year and all of next year. And in November, we'll likely have to come forward with additional quantitative easing.
I would agree. I mean, I think fundamentally and economically, there's definitely some dark clouds on the horizon in terms of we're all drowning, the governments are drowning under debt and unemployment is high. I guess the sort of the curveball that is so difficult for the likes of you and myself in terms of investing your own money is if, you know, there's a medical solution. And I did see yesterday, we had Sir Martin Sorrell, who was, you know, the advertising guy. I think he was quoted as he was predicting a full throated recovery in 2021, predicated on there being an availability of a vaccine. Now, is there a possible scenario, upside risk here, whereby the central banks bridge us over this dark period, over the valley of COVID, and then we see a major recovery next year? So if you sort of take a defensive stature, which clearly CCLA, you know, may or may not be doing, but if you take a too defensive strategy, then you miss up on the bounce because investors will price that potential medical recovery, which could come through any day, you know, sort of like into the price before you get a chance to buy back in. It's a sort of difficult, really difficult balance and equation to solve.
I absolutely accept that that is a risk, but frankly, we think that an awful lot of good news is already baked in prices.
Yeah.
And when one thinks about some of the big picture challenges, they don't get changed if there is a vaccine. So, for example, we have deteriorating demographics. We have an aging population. Really difficult to get economic growth. The number of people working is declining. and we are in an economy with relatively low productivity trends. The second challenge, of course, is this high level of indebtedness. That's going to take years to work off. The last time that we had low bond yields and rising inflation with official sanction was in the United States between 1942 and 1951. And then bond yields were kept to a ceiling rate of 2.5%. Inflation was allowed to run, and hate press, though government debt halved over that period. Now, that was a terrible period for bonds, terrible period for gold, interestingly, but a good period for genuine growth companies. And that leads on to the next issue of, so all this cheap money, what's it done? Well, frankly, it's kept an awful lot of businesses going that should otherwise, in the capital market system, have failed. And that means residual profitability for those who are operating is impaired. Far too many people producing far too many goods that people, frankly, don't want to buy. And against that backdrop, I'm absolutely confident that you have to stick to quality in this environment. And I'm driving quality as companies that have some control over their pricing and some control over their costs, as evidenced by a persistent return on capital employed.
So you could get a scenario on the inflation side where you have CPI being sort of held down by technology and excess capacity, as you talk about. But equally, you could see asset price inflation if governments run their economies hot to remove their debt levels, which could see sort of the likes of housing and stocks, equities do very well. So you could have that huge divergence here. You could get an asset price boom, but effectively at the CPI level, and salaries and people like, so you have a real decrease in people's own sort of like income stream, but for people with assets and hard assets could actually go through very well. Is that sort of like a potential scenario?
That is absolutely a potential scenario. And I think that the flip side that we have to focus on as well is what happens to the labor share of revenue. Really, since the end of the 1970s, shareholders had it good at the expense of workers. So the portion of revenues has flowed through to profits that have supported share progress has been very profound, and it's obviously been accompanied by a markdown in inflation. I would suggest that the rise of popularity of Mr. Biden in the States is emblematic, with the expectation that the workers now think that somehow it's just not right, it's not fair, and that if we see the labor share of GDP begin to rise again, then I do think that profits are going to fall back. And then again, we absolutely have to be focused on quality. Otherwise, again, we're faced with negative cycle of falling profitability and falling valuations.
And that sort of environment with a number of sort of moving balls and moving targets, what are you looking at as a potential sort of like investments going forward? What's on your stock watch list in terms of, redeploying some of the cash?
James, why don't you talk about some of our current ideas?
Sure. I mean, in terms of, equity space, I mean, we've retained, relatively high equity allocation, really on the basis that James has just been talking about, and a focus on quality growth. I mean, names that for us continue to stand out as very attractive in this environment are stocks like Agilent. So Agilent works within the life science industry. Life science is quite a small industry. It's quite oligopolistic in terms of the number of providers into it. So there's a few competitors, and Agilent focuses on bioanalytics and electronic measurement, predominantly where it's typically a number one player. It's a razor blade model. It's the sort of business that we really like. So it's got effectively revenues that repeat through time. It doesn't have to go out and make new sales all the time, so it puts an instrument or a series of instruments in the laboratory, and then it gets a revenue stream from maintaining those instruments, servicing them, and providing the consumables. And for us, that business is extremely well-placed on a long-term view. Really, as the burden of regulation, particularly in things like food and pharmaceuticals, where people demand to know the quality of the substances that they're injecting into themselves or putting in their mouths, ultimately become more and more important. And so that company is benefiting from a number of long-term secular trends, and is a company that also maintains very high margins and very attractive and growing returns on invested capital.
And would it also benefit if the world have to make sort of billions and billions of doses of vaccine?
The COVID? It does play into the pharmaceutical kind of supply chain. So yes, it is a beneficiary of sorts, but it's not a major beneficiary per se. This really is around broad testing, and it has many industries and verticals that it's exposed to, not just pharmaceuticals. So anything that you can think of that needs to be tested in a laboratory, you know, these guys have involvement in that. So that's one example. I mean, another which we think, on a sort of similar vein, but still very well placed longer term. We talked about the importance of food safety, nutrition, a stock that we have been following and looking at closely and now own in the portfolios is Kerry Group. It's an Irish domiciled business, but it's a global business. And it's a specialist ingredient and flavour technology company. And it's an area of the market we really like. We like it because while some of the food groups have struggled to grow, the complexity of creating recipes, foods and flavours, particularly natural elements to that.
Clean labels.
Clean label, exactly. That can be sustainably sourced is growing much faster. And Kerry's a big beneficiary of that through time. So those are a couple of examples to give you a kind of flavour of what we've been looking at.
And top level, are you playing sort of offence or defence or a bit of a mixture? Your offence on things you really like, but sort of like defence on a lot of other stuff.
We've been looking to place the portfolio in companies that ultimately are masters of their own destiny, that are, you know, in our eyes, some of the great companies of the world, and that ultimately are not hugely sort of operationally levered. So typically they're benefiting from secular rather than cyclical growth, and where we can see those growth drivers being maintained you know, for a reasonable amount of time into the future. And for those companies, typically they're capital light. So that means higher returns on invested capital. So they're cash, very cash generative, and that cash can be returned to our shareholders or reinvested for future growth in the business. And we think that's really fundamentally important in a world that's mired in debt. Companies that have clean balance sheets, are very cash generative, and are really in control of their destiny really, really matters in this environment.
So it's worth paying for quality, essentially.
Quality, yeah, exactly. So, you know, strong cash conversion is one of the hallmarks of that. And I think just to one other point that you make, which is, you know, are we defensive or offensive? Well, we think we're both. So, I mean, by focusing on quality, that has elements of defensiveness, but also looking for businesses that can grow on secular drivers, you know, that's essentially offensive. So effectively, they're going to be beneficiaries and they're not highly dependent on cyclical expansion in the economy.
And then do you use any, on the defense side, do you use any protection in terms of derivatives or you buy futures or anything like that? Or do you just really play the long game and therefore that gives you the natural hedge that you, if we do go through another correction, because you've bought quality, it will recover over the sort of the short to medium term?
We're looking to play the long game and underpin all of our endeavours in terms of the free cash flow that we get back from our companies. So to your question on derivatives, no, we don't dabble in derivatives or complex options. We, from time to time, do currency hedging, really though on the underlying assets that we own, and that, you know, relatively seldom. It very much depends on the currency markets and the currency pairs. But no, underlying and underpinning the portfolio, it's a clear focus on free cash flow and free cash flow growth.
And then what sort of like data would you sort of monitor or look at to give you an early read of the sort of the economy and where the market's going? Would you look at the sort of like, I don't know, BBB corporate bank debt to see whether that, you know, whether that was moving between investment grade or junk, or, you know, the yields on it? Or would you look at sort of alternative data sources or even bank shares or anything like that? Is there anything of note you look at that gives you an early read or might give investors an early read of where the direction of the market's going?
We are absolutely at the economic data that is published, most of which is trailing, but it's important that we keep an eye on it, as obviously it forms the base plate for the next set of releases. We certainly look at market indicators, including credit spreads, and also at lead indicators from entities such as the Institute of Supply Management and the Purchasing Managers. And we believe that we are able not only therefore to have a perspective of where the market is going in terms of economic fundamentals, but also the probable behavior of investors. And one of the areas that I suspect is most neglected in our industry is thinking about how investors actually behave in different conditions. And as James has identified, we want to buy great companies, but we want to pay the right price. And therefore, we spend a lot of time trimming in and trimming out according to variations in price relative to valuations.
Okay. What would be the sort of the maximum level you'd have for a stock position? Would that be sort of 5%? And is that sort of like the greatest, sort of like the largest size before you start trimming?
In terms of equity, we run a very diversified book. So we typically have between 80 to 100 securities in our global portfolios. And the maximum position size is normally not greater than 3.5%, but that typically below that level.
Okay. And then if sort of any ingenious investors want to do their own sort of ESG sort of fund, how would you sort of like practically be able to do this? Or is it best just to go for a fund that specializes in it? Or is there any simple things? Because, I mean, we had Boohoo, unfortunately, having allegations was in the media recently. It just shows you how difficult this is to get right. We had a lot of sort of even professionals who had to exit their positions. So how would be sort of like the best sort of, you know, sort of tip or just general advice you would give to ingenious investors who want to try ESG investing on themselves?
You know, it's amazing what's available on the internet just by using search engines. If you were to look up a company and then type in ESG, the number of chat rooms and data sources and reports that have been filed on companies and what they're doing is huge. And Boohoo's challenges were well recognized by those of us who took ESG seriously. And frankly, I think that it was a disgrace that people held Boohoo if they also said that ESG mattered to them. As for funds, I would encourage investors not so much to look at the current holdings that could only be a snapshot through time, but look about how managers make decisions and whether or not the investor can really trust what the manager is saying and whether it is backed up by fact.
Okay, guys, that's absolutely brilliant, and many thanks for your time. Just finally, and if an investor wants to put any money into sort of like CCLA, where would be the best place to contact the business? Just through the website?
We run money for churches, charities, and local authorities, and indeed we have a website, which is www.ccla.co.uk.
Brilliant, guys. Well, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Supply Atme Capital, up 4%, 0.51 pence. At four, Omega Diagnostics, up 18% to 88.5. At three, Greatland Gold, up 12.5% to 22.4 pence. At two, Deltic Energy, down 8% to 1.45. And at one, Escape Hunt, most followed company. I did do a video covering those yesterday. They did rise this morning by 10%, but now they're flat at 7.75 pence. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Union Jack Oil. That is half-year report. Joint four, Expediator and Symphony Environmental, positive coronavirus test results. At three, Tech Capital guidance update. Yeah, at two, On the Market, of course, on the podcast today, Taylor Wimpey signs On the Market listing agreement. And at one, Salt Lake Potash, Lake Way, 60% completion there. And, of course, heading towards production in the first quarter of next year. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.